The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to Pollock and Thurston. It is January the 15th. The ongoing storyline of the Buffalo Bills continues. Broncos get out of the way. And now we've got Sunday night meeting. Is it the Baltimore Ravens on
Sunday night?
It is
the Sunday Ravens. Night? The Bills lost to the Ravens in the regular season, though.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, tensions are very high, I'm sure.
I think the Ravens are a slight favorite, at least last I looked.
Well, will you be watching this game on Sunday evening?
Certainly. Certainly I will.
Okay. Well, I probably won't be. Just cards on the table. But following from afar here in Toronto, we have plenty to get into today. It's one of our favorite topics, filings and documents. There's plenty of them this week. We're going to chat a little bit about UFC's media rights. What are they seeking? What's realistic? And who is not going to be bidding on these rights? TKO in Saudi Arabia. What a marriage. And it looks like they're going to be walking down the aisle and conceiving of a child, dubbed their new boxing promotion, according to the New York Times. We've got Netflix viewership data. We've got quarter hours for the new 3 hour era of SmackDown. Brandon, did you sit down and watch any minutes of the 3 hour SmackDown last Friday night?
I don't think so.
180 minutes of SmackDown this past Friday.
I watched. Yeah. You're 180 ahead of me there.
I did
listen to several. Well, I think almost all of the minutes of Rewind to SmackDown, though.
A painful episode. We will see. How many of those people stuck around to the bitter end of that show? But
not even good enough for a 2 hour show, I heard.
Barely a 60 minute show, and here we are going 3 hours. My God. Janelle Grant filings, Brandon, they were going fast and furious. I think a forest, might be, gone after this, particular week of papers.
It's all electronic, I think. Unless people are printing their own copies out.
Yeah. I guess hard copies are a thing of the past when it comes to all of these filings, but let's try and go in a sequential order here. And we did do a breaking news show last week when the SEC announcement came down that Vince McMahon was facing a $400,000 fine and over $1.3 million that he must reimburse his former company, WWE. Minor accounting errors. And, yes, and a statement that certainly got a lot of attention from people, including the lead wording from one Vince McMahon: "The case is closed."
Yes,
yes. I think he could have had a big banner that said "Mission Accomplished" right behind him.
I can't confirm that. Well, I guess the SEC case has been settled, but the SDNY case that was reportedly investigating allegations of sexual assault and sex trafficking against him. The Wall Street Journal has reported that there was such an investigation. SDNY would not comment on the status of that investigation when I emailed them last week. So I do think it's unlikely at this point that there's going to be charges brought against him related to that. But I don't know that they ever formally closed these things. Anyway, a FOIA request has been sent the way
do you
of
think,
SDNY.
Do you think he immediately was kicking himself when he tweeted out this statement that, oh, I should have clarified which case is closed? People might think everything is done. Do you think
everybody's down there in the weeds with us? They want to know the specifics of exactly which.
What if this is misinterpreted by people? What if they think everything? I'm in the clear now.
Are you alleging that Vince McMahon is making a misleading statement?
What I say a lot of times is totally different than what I think. And the public doesn't understand that sometimes. As a businessman, you have to throw things out there. It's not really the way you feel. But it controls thought process by doing that.
Okay, everyone, we're all on the same page here, okay? As a businessman, you have to understand these things. These are the rules, okay? It controls thought process out there. But let us go back. We have gone through the SEC settlement and in kind of an expanded form. Do you have any kind of thoughts since we spoke last Thursday, Brandon, coming out of this? And then we will get into this week's furious filings back and forth.
About the SEC thing in particular?
The SEC thing in particular. I mean, they did outline the fact, you know, a very key part here is not just the fact that this was, you know, very clearly we saw like this was not Vince McMahon's money that was used for this. This was, you know, company
money.
Doesn't
matter whose money. So this is a great one to get to. It doesn't matter whose money it was. It was money was used to protect the company. That's a company expense. Just as just as Nick Khan can't go into his personal account and pay for the production of SmackDown, mm-hmm. that would create more profitability than there actually is for WWE. And especially when you're a publicly traded company, you can't do that.
And this led to the misreporting of multiple, quarterly results that, you know, we had to see WWE go back and redo their books for this period. And the end result being the $400,000 fine and then the reimbursement. I mean, this is largely like I won't even call it an inconvenience for Vince McMahon, but it is the end result here that we have.
I did the math on, you know, a really conservative estimate of what his net worth is. Let's say it's $2 billion based on the stock he's liquidated and the stock that he still has, $2 billion. So first, you compare that to somebody in the U.S. with a median net worth of $200,000. That's his $400,000 fine from the SEC is essentially a parking ticket of $40. That is what you will be fined if you park on the wrong side of the street in Buffalo, New York. And the $1.3 million that he has to repay to WWE, which we should explain exactly why he has to do that. That's roughly equivalent to $130 for somebody with the median income in the United States. So, I may or may not have paid a speeding ticket in the last year or so. That was a lot more than that.
I have definitely paid speeding tickets above that amount, in the state of New York too.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway,
did you have to appear in court in New York?
I was summoned, and I could not make that court date for my location. But yeah, they definitely nabbed me.
So we should explain why is he being ordered to repay? Now this is a settlement agreement that he made with the SEC, but as a result of that settlement, he has to repay. Not only is he fined $400,000, but he's also got to repay WWE $1.3 million because of these NDA payments, which were not originally recorded as expenses. That caused WWE to report that they were even more profitable than they were. And profitability, not only does that make the stock price probably a little bit stronger, which he owned a lot of, but it also had bearing on his executive compensation. You're compensated as an executive in part based on some performance indicators that the board of directors do some math and they decide how much extra you're going to get. And because WWE was even more profitable because they didn't have to report these millions of dollars in NDA payments that he had settled on the side in secret to the knowledge of maybe nobody except himself and Jerry McDivitt, WWE was more profitable. That caused executives to be compensated more generously. So he's being ordered. I don't know how they did the math here. I don't believe they broke out the math, but he's being ordered to repay WWE $1.3 million because of that.
Yeah, it just causes a major, I won't even call it major, but a ripple effect regardless of like these improperly misreported payments and the residual effect of a publicly traded company. And why is this important? Again, this is always what we go back to, is that, again, if this is happening in the mid-90s, this isn't happening in the mid-90s. Like, this is not a public story. This is not a case where you have a board of directors to answer to. And there's a great argument that none of this would have seen the light of day in terms of any kind of scandal or payment agreements, misappropriated or unreported funds. This is a story because this is a publicly traded company, and that drew the attention of reporters at the Wall Street Journal that are focusing on this as a publicly traded company.
Great. I'm not sure if it's a legal issue at all, or if it's certainly not the legal issue that it is in a publicly traded company. It's not the media issue for the Wall Street Journal if it's not a publicly traded company. So those two factors definitely made this a bigger story that, as you said, might not have even made it to the public eye if WWE was still private.
So that takes us to this past Monday. So last week when we were on the show, we were kind of outlining dates to look out for, what is important in the next wave of the Janelle Grant suit following the stay being lifted last month. And we were pointing to this Wednesday, where we might have an amended complaint to talk about. An amended complaint being that Janelle Grant's side, they were basically going to refile an updated complaint. We didn't know what would be contained in that amended complaint, but today was the day they had set out as their date to report it. We go to Monday, and I had an inkling that maybe something will be delayed on Wednesday, as I had sought some information, and we didn't get any response to about this particular Wednesday. So Monday, this comes down that Janelle Grant's side, they are asking, number one, they want to have a status conference, and they also want an extension on this time to refile because of the SEC ruling last week, taking into account the effect that that has on their amended complaint. So we can start there, but that's essentially what was Janelle Grant's filing this past Monday, asking for a request.
Yeah, it's not clear to me how they're going to argue that the news that just emerged about Vince's settlement with the SEC is going to affect their argument. It's not clear, in fact, at all to us exactly what they might be changing and modifying about the complaint. But that is what they're requesting. And now already Vince's attorneys and WWE's attorneys last night, I sent it to you at like 10:30 at night last night. Yes. They have both responded with arguments about why Grant should not be allowed to amend the complaint now. The time has passed. They must be arguing that there was a 3-week. I'm not up on my rules of federal civil procedure. I apologize. I believe they're arguing that there was a 3-week time limit from the moment that they refiled their motions to compel this case into arbitration, and that 3-week time limit expires on the 13th. I think.
Yeah. They're leaning on something called the local rules of civil procedure that I'm sure is on everybody's reading device. And so Vince McMahon had filed on December 21st, basically filing another motion to compel arbitration. WWE followed suit that same day, John Laurinaitis the next day. And yeah, according to these local rules of civil procedure, it's 21 days to respond to that. And that 21st day would have been this past Monday. Yeah, I don't understand how one was... The Grant side had this date in mind for the 15th. The rules state 21 days. I don't understand why this timeline was different, but it was. And one is asking for an extension and the other is standing in front of that request.
Yes. So this is something that I suppose the new judge in this case, Sarah F. Russell, will have to decide pretty soon, is whether or not to grant this motion to the Grant side to allow them some extension of time to submit an amended complaint or not. And we discussed this a couple of weeks ago. We have, the Grant side filed these emails from Ann Callis between her side and the defendant side, where they're proposing, the plaintiff side is proposing this schedule. And Jessica Rosenberg, who is Vince McMahon's attorney, responded saying, we will get back to you just like an hour later. This was on December 16th, I believe. And then there was no response at that point. At least that's how the Grant side is presenting it. And then a week later, they suddenly refiled their motions to compel. And these are very similar to the motions to compel that they filed before this case was put on hold in June. It's just been resumed now, and there's disagreements about whether or not the case is really formally or off of the stay and so forth. This will be something for the judge to decide.
Yeah. And in the filing by Jessica Rosenberg, they had stated that they're requesting that the district court move the pending motion to compel arbitration, or alternatively order the plaintiff to respond to the motion no later than next Monday. So I guess they are willing to give wiggle room with a deadline of next Monday to respond to this. Jessica Rosenberg also sending us and other outlets a statement that, quote, the recent federal investigation resulted in no criminal indictments from the Southern District of New York, while the SEC settlement relates to minor accounting issues at WWE that have nothing to do with this case. Any claims to the contrary made by Janelle Grant's team are another desperate PR stunt.
And I suppose I should add here, it's not just that the defendants are trying to prevent the plaintiffs from amending the complaint, but they're also saying that you've run out of time to even respond to our motions to compel, and you could have, you know, get presented your argument, but you've run out of time to do that, and therefore they want the judge to just decide now on their motions to compel without hearing from the Grant side, because the defendants argue that you had your time to do it and the time is up.
Yeah. So playing amateur lawyer here, which is not my forte, but it would appear that the Janelle Grant side, like, they are being told, hey, you've had 3 weeks to do this. You have run out the clock. Their side is stating, yes, but we had this SEC settlement come down last week. We believe that that is material to this case, and therefore we should have some more time on the clock to run this out. If I am just trying to get into the Grant side of this, one question I would have is that, if we are understanding here that WWE did not have knowledge of these agreements mm-hmm. that Vince McMahon had into place, and what the SEC ruling made, that this was a violation, does that invalidate the NDA? Like, I would be arguing that. I don't know if the judge would agree, but that would at least be something I would be pushing if I was the plaintiffs in this.
That could be something that they raise. A friend of ours pointed out that we missed that last week. That maybe that's something that Grant will raise, is that this agreement was made in secret, and Vince, according to this press release and filing from the SEC, Vince never made WWE's auditors and board and other executives aware of this. It sounds like only he, the other party that he was signing this NDA with, and this goes for the $7.5 million NDA that he made a couple of years before the Grant NDA with the former talent, who alleges that he coerced her into oral sex. So, and that incident is allegedly from 2005, but this NDA was made many years later in 2018 or 19. Yeah. So this stuff was done in secret, according to the SEC. Maybe there's an argument that because WWE didn't know about it, that doesn't bind WWE to this agreement. I don't know. But that'll be something for them to raise if they end up raising it. I guess I would think that, you know, if anybody was empowered to bind WWE to an agreement, you would think it would be the person who was the CEO, and for that matter, the chairman of the board at the time, which is Vince. So does he have to inform other structures in WWE for WWE to be bound to such an agreement? I don't know. Now we're getting into case law. I don't know.
Well, the WWE essentially just piggybacked off of the Vince McMahon filing. They put out on Tuesday night, they made their own filing, and essentially stating that Janelle Grant's request for an extension of time is untimely. That's a mouthful. Janelle Grant's request for an extension of time is untimely, and she has not shown good cause for the extension. The request should be denied, and accordingly, WWE's motion to compel arbitration should be granted. And no filing by John Laurinaitis, but you would imagine he is in lockstep with this as well.
Yes, yeah, so he has filed his own rejoinder about the motion to compel. It looks like, I imagine that WWE and Vince, being much more wealthy entities than John Laurinaitis, they have the legal power to understand this case and, you know, put forth the strong legal arguments, and maybe John Laurinaitis doesn't so much, and he's just sort of agreeing with their side so far.
So I think that is everything up to date on the filings, and a lot of this rests on Judge Sarah F. Russell to make some kind of ruling in all of this. And, you know, a key argument, I mean, she could very well just make this decision that, you know, arbitration is approved, and that would be a major win for Vince McMahon's side if they compel arbitration, and or conversely, going the other route. But it is sort of a wait and see approach until the judge makes a ruling on this.
Yeah, and I guess we could discuss too the 2018 NDA with the former talent. We did get some information in this litigation filing from the SEC, sort of detailing that there was a demand letter that was sent demanding, I think it's more than $11 million or something like that, from Vince McMahon in advance of that $7.5 million agreement being made. $18 million. The individual was seeking $18 million to resolve individual A's claims against McMahon and WWE. So just an idea. This is a new detail that we didn't know before.
Yeah, it states here that from November 2018 to February 19, in connection with the resolution of these claims, McMahon's attorney's firm billed WWE more than $23,000 for approximately 29 hours of work.
Presumably that's K&L Gates and that's Jerry McDivitt.
Yes, so we now know Jerry McDivitt's going rate.
Yes, did you do the math? I did the math.
What does that work out to, an hourly fee?
It's a lot. It's hundreds of dollars
more, an hour. More than a parking ticket. On February 13th of 2019, the party signed a confidential settlement agreement whereby McMahon agreed to pay Individual A $7.5 million over 5 years, and Individual A agreed to waive her rights to sue McMahon and WWE, not disclose the existence or substance of her claims, the agreement, or the payments, because such disclosure would do irreparable harm to McMahon and to WWE. McMahon signed the Individual A agreement on his own behalf and separately on the behalf of WWE.
Yes. And again, why does this matter to WWE? How did WWE benefit from this? Because these individuals, whether it's Chanel Grant or the former W talent, they agreed to release not just Vince from liability, but also the company. And Vince signed on behalf of the company because he wanted to protect the company, apparently. He didn't have to include WWE as a party to this, presumably. So that's why WWE is so involved in this. Additionally, this does point out, and the press release pointed it out that we read last week, is that this caused not reporting these amounts caused WWE to overstate their net income, which is like the final measurement of profit. Think of it like your net pay after all your taxes are taken out, what you're actually left with. This caused WWE to overstate their net income by 8% in 2019 and by 1.7% in 2021. So, I mean, that's even if we're saying, you know, okay, these are people who have millions and billions of dollars. Well, it's just a percentage. This was a pretty big difference to your net income for a publicly traded company as well. So I would contrast that with Vince's claims that these were minor accounting errors. This was an 8% overstatement in your annual net income.
Minor, just, you know, clerical error. Okay. Haven't you ever sent an email and not forgotten to CC someone? These things happen. Things happen, Brandon. I think it is worth noting that there was this ominous tweet, and God knows I love to dissect emojis online. It's my favorite hobby to dissect. But we did get someone who could be an extremely powerful ally for Vince McMahon in all of this, and that is Turki Al-Sheikh of the Saudi Arabian regime, who posted this picture of Vince McMahon with not one, not two, three heart emojis. And this comes right around the same time period where this New York Times story dropped about TKO and Saudi Arabia getting involved in a boxing league. We know that Vince McMahon was a very key conduit between WWE and by extension TKO with Saudi Arabia. We don't need to like read into this, but I don't think this was done by accident. And I think you do look at this as somebody that if there was a person that you would want to have on your side, if you are Vince McMahon, this is the person who his influence across combat sports has grown exponentially in the last number of years.
I don't know anything about this. Could Vince be involved in this boxing project as a private if you know, if the Saudi government and the GEA is involved in it as a separate entity, what would stop Vince from doing business?
Nothing would stop him. Well, like he has, you know, other than that, you know, one off, you know, he was, you know, somewhat involved in the Inoki Ali fight and that Sugar Ray Leonard mm-hmm. boxing fight. But let's remember, TKO here is not starting a boxing league from scratch. If anything, like, they're being licensed to be the promoters. And if you're a Turkey LL Sheikh, who are the most effective promoters in your lifetime? He's got Dana White, and I'm sure he views Vince McMahon as still having a value in terms of being someone with a promotional talent that some may disagree with, but I would imagine that Turki Alal Sheikh is not one of his critics and might see a value in having a Vince McMahon involved, having him inside to help promote whether it be boxing or whatever. But you know, he's someone that wields a lot of power in all of this, and if he is pushing for a Vince McMahon, I mean, I do not have this belief that there is no pathway back for a Vince McMahon. I think we have seen wild things occur, and I don't rule anything out.
Yeah, it was made pretty clear in public comments from WWE or TKO executives that the person who was really instrumental in that relationship with the Saudi government was Vince himself. Yep. And when Vince left, Nick Khan took over that relationship, and that relationship has continued to be strong enough to do a Royal Rumble there pretty soon. So it aligns that, you know, Turki Alal Sheikh thinks fondly of him, and he probably had a good relationship with Vince. I guess the if you're TKO, do you want to be deeply involved in a business again that has your disgraced former executive chairman and maybe the unwanted media attention that will bring? Or maybe it's just not that big of a deal. I don't know.
I don't know how big of a deal it would be to not have him as one of your, you know, front-facing people. This wouldn't be a case of Vince McMahon running WWE again, but it would be having, you know, if someone is a very significant ally and is pushing for this. I mean, he has a lot of influence, and, you know, you could read into this whatever you do, but there's still quite a lot of baggage that comes with the Vince McMahon. And despite his tweet, the cases are not closed, because there's two still major ones pending in the Janelle Grant case and this Ring Boy suit that is not going to be moving forward until a decision is rendered in Maryland. So you do still have all of that hanging over top of Vince McMahon, who is going to be 80 years old this year.
As Mark Shapiro said, he's going through some litigation.
He's going through, but he's great at breakfast. Great at breakfast.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. I guess if there's one thing we've kind of learned, and it's been reinforced to me from Hulk Hogan getting booed, is that, I mean, you've got two very different audiences with two very different levels of tolerance for political or moral issues. And WWE, at least when you're in LA, maybe it's because it's LA, but WWE certainly is more that audience is more sensitive to that than the UFC audiences who loves Donald Trump and all of that.
While we're on the TKO story, so this had come out last week from the New York Times, and essentially stating that an imminent announcement is coming about TKO partnering with Saudi Arabia to get some kind of boxing promotion off the ground. And this would, in essence, be what we have heard from past descriptions. And here is Mark Shapiro not too long ago when he sat down with Alex Sherman and discussing TKO's potential interest in getting involved in boxing.
Anything we do from an ownership perspective or a new league perspective going forward will probably be organic. I mean, boxing is something that Dana White has consistently brought up. We're not going to go buy or acquire any kind of boxing agencies or boxing federations, if you will, but could we organically start something and or bring on a partner that fuels that financially fuels that, so we take no risk? That's something we're really trapped into.
So what Mark Shapiro is stating is that, hey, we are not starting from scratch and are going to put millions and millions into trying to carve out a space in boxing for us. What we would do is find somebody else that's going to take all of the financial risk, and we are going to be, you know, not as like we will take in what's reported in here is something around a $30 million fee to be able to promote and utilize their promotional muscle to get this off the ground. But this would be underwritten by Saudi Arabia.
Yep. And, you know, they certainly have the money to do it, and that this is increasingly becoming the center for all combat sports, whether it's a work or a shoot.
TKO had told the New York Times it has nothing to announce at the moment, and this would be, you know, something that Dana White has spoken pretty openly about, like the plans for this. And really, this goes back years of Dana White talking about the idea of getting into boxing. But, you know, given the relationship that has intensified with Saudi Arabia, they believe now is that time to capitalize, and we will see what incarnation this takes and what level they are going to be involved here, if they have any name boxers attached to this, or if this is going to be almost a development type of system where they're going to rely on trying to create some of their own stars and on what platforms as well. But it does give them another potential, you know, piece in the combat sports puzzle of, you know, more rights fees, more things to just have on the table as they're about to go into all these negotiations for UFC's rights as well.
Yeah. MMA, wrestling, boxing, and
PBR. Yeah. The quadrant that is the combat sports connoisseur.
Do you think that there's a strong opportunity? I can imagine there being an argument that there's a strong opportunity in boxing. If you look at the history of boxing, especially in the heavyweight, weight class. The history of boxing is the history of all these great heavyweight fighters. And there's been very few since, to my memory, since, you know, basically the Tyson and Lewis fights, which are back in what, the late 90s, early 2000s. And there's been a Tyson Fury here and there, but there hasn't been this continued lineage of who's the great heavyweight boxer.
I think the idea, and you can take this from some of Dana White's comments, would be, I mean, he wants as best he can to replicate the UFC model, but there's a lot of restrictions in boxing that don't allow for that. But it's the idea that we could have all of these fighters under one umbrella, that we could matchmake without resistance from fighters and be able to create that where, you know, in the UFC, you have essentially 80% of the top fighters and you're pretty free to match them all unless it's an outlier of a fight you can't put together. But I think that's the idea here of getting away from a lot of the resistance, rights that boxers have that mixed martial artists do not possess.
Does doing business outside of the US in a country like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, does that help you avoid the Ali Act?
I don't know for certain, but my understanding is that that would give them more latitude in other places that they would not have a piece of. And
this will not be, it sounds like this will not be a TKO company, but a company that TKO would own a lot of, but not would not be controlling owners, maybe.
Yeah, this would obviously probably be like a Saudi Arabia government funded league through the public investment fund that I would imagine, yeah, TKO having equity in this, and it's a guaranteed revenue stream that they would have every year, that it's a guaranteed whatever it is, your 30 million that you're getting, and you are the promoter. As Dana White has likened it to, we would be the HBO. We would not be the matchmakers itself or the actual boxing promoter. We would be the distributor and utilizing our resources to promote and to take in a licensing fee. I mean, it is a lot lower risk than the idea of this Zuffa boxing that they had years ago, where it seemed like they were going to get in and create their own thing. But Dana's already talking about expanding, having an office extended in Las Vegas for this boxing entity. So I think it's only a matter of time before this is formally rolled out, it seemed like, from the New York Times reporting. Let's talk a little bit about, let's go to Netflix. So we got a landmark announcement from Netflix. We got our first global viewership data for the week of January the 6th, Brandon. Were you refreshing on as this update came and where Raw was going to rank on global rankings? And we get a whole territorial breakdown. And there, of the global top 10 shows last week, Raw coming in fourth place behind Missing You, American Primeval, and falling to Jerry Springer Fights, Camera, Action. But look at that topping departure and Virgin River and Gabriel Iglesias, maybe getting some of that raw bump. I don't know any of these shows at all, nor do I have any desire to click on any of them.
I'm embarrassed to say I'm looking at this for the first time. I've been busy the last couple of days, but I guess this tells you. So when they announced the global number on a Thursday, which was after the Monday where they debuted, they announced 4.9 million global views at that time. Now this is through Sunday. So everybody's, you know, I'm sure got their calculators out, is trying to think about what is the delayed viewing pattern like. But that's interesting to know that this is probably something that's, I mean, this is going to be the biggest viewership maybe ever that they do on Netflix, but this will probably rank, again, looking at what the top 10 consists of. 2.3 million is the bottom. They'll probably continue to make the list. Maybe not every week, but in some weeks, we'll at least get a look at the global viewership, and it'll take 6-7 days to come out, but we will get that look. I haven't seen any press releases come out about Monday's viewership. Have you?
I have not. No,
no,
not amazingly not. I don't know how much what plethora of press releases are going to be coming out. Interestingly
they waited
enough,
until Thursday last week. So, right,
that is true. It is interesting to note, and you can go through all the different countries in Canada. Like, I was curious because all three shows are airing in Canada. None finishing. Sorry, my mistake. Raw was sixth, but no SmackDown, no NXT in the top 10. But I mean, in Canada, it did outrank Squid Game. But man, Jerry Springer was just a behemoth. Okay, Squid Game season 2 was ranked second. It's Squid Game season 1 that was amazingly in the top 10. So it is interesting to look at some of these stats. But there we go.
It tells you that. So, of course, in the United States, we're only getting Raw. You're getting all of the content. But it tells you that SmackDown's probably not going to be in there, maybe ever.
No. We had, so the amount of hours, 17.7 million hours viewed, which, interestingly enough, that is what it feels like to watch one episode of SmackDown in this new format. Yes. With a varying runtime, we have. So there you have it, folks. These are the new viewership stats that we have courtesy of Netflix. And so how does this work? Within 5 to 6 weeks, what is it that is there not additional data that Netflix puts out about a month later as it relates?
I don't think so. I haven't heard that. What are you thinking?
Okay. I need to double check on this. I feel there's something that comes out in a number of weeks that gives further insight into this, but I will have to double check on that. There's a lot of numbers.
There's definitely, what there definitely is on this top 10 list is there is a download button, so you can download yourself a comma separated value spreadsheet. And I think you can get the entire history of their disclosures of what their viewing data is. It's just the top 10 though.
Who would not be doing such a thing? Look at this. So you can get your global list, country list, most popular list. Load up Excel and just go wild.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets. Guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
While we're talking about SmackDown, we are now two episodes deep into the new 3-hour format, and the man who was able to get all the quarterly hour breakdowns, patreon.com/WrestleNomics, and I think these are interesting to see how the first 2 weeks performed. So for the January 3rd edition of the show, which was the first in the 3-hour era, the show itself ended up averaging just over 1.5 million. We had let's pull this up as we break this down here for everybody. So January the 3rd, SmackDown averaging 1,528,000 viewers and a 0.45. And if you look at the 3 hour breakdown, this ranged from 1.63 million for the first hour down to 1.39 million in hour number three. And then, just any takeaways like 2 weeks in of what we have seen here, because it does seem like we are quickly establishing a similar pattern to Raw where you do get a decline throughout the show. Not to say like it's a terrible number, certainly not by USA standards for 10 to 11 PM, but, there is like that third hour drop that was very, you know, that was always the case pretty much for each Raw.
Yeah, the slide isn't too bad for the first week, right? But I think I have the other week here too for this most recent Monday, which is here. The slide looks a little bit more, negative of a slope, especially for that last hour. But I would agree. This is probably going to be, you only have 2 weeks of this, but it's probably going to be a weaker third hour as Raw was when it was 3 hours.
Yeah, there was this past Monday, throughout the show, there was like a 13% viewership drop, a 23% drop in the demo. If you're going from hour one to hour three, I would take as someone that watched the SmackDown, the fact that 1.2 million people were still there for the end of this show, I would be holding a parade for those people that made it to the end.
Yeah, sorry. And this is, I don't know why that's got the third on it. Disregard. Well, I'll fix that later. But it was just not, it was more negative this week than it was last week.
Before we move on, let's quickly talk about an impromptu super chat. Brandon, any idea? AEW having a deal in India for streaming. What is it? Do you know what the streaming situation is like in India?
I have been asked this a couple times in DMs. I understood at one point, this was a while ago, that there was a delay in streaming. But they're on what, Eurosport in India? But I have not heard anything, unfortunately.
Okay. There you have it, folks. Gotta seek your AEW out other places digitally. All right, let's continue on, and we can talk a little bit about some UFC media rights. So this past week, Bloomberg reported that UFC seeking $1 billion annually for its latest agreements that are coming up at the end of this year. And that billion number, always a nice round number that get floated around and picked up. But certainly there is a lot of interest in the UFC rights.
And their exclusive window is ending soon, right?
Yeah, they're in the midst of a several-month exclusive window at the moment. But we'll go back to Alex Sherman because he interviewed Jay Maureen. He is the head of global sports at Amazon Prime. And he was asked flat out, are you interested in UFC?
UFC?
Yeah. UFC for sure. You know, what Dana and that team, that's an incredible success story. They've grown that into just an incredibly valuable franchise, incredibly passionate fan base. I have huge respect for them over there. And, if that comes to market, I think they're an exclusive window right now. We'd be very interested in taking a look, as I expect every broadcaster would.
So there you go. Really holding his cards close to the vest. Yeah. UFC, where we definitely want UFC. You know, as we have always stated, the fact is the more bidders, the better you have it. And at the moment, UFC is the big sports deal that is up this year. And you know that there's going to be interest in retaining at least a part of the package from ESPN. There is the expectation, will Netflix continue their dive into live sports with UFC? Amazon sees a very clearly when you have someone like Jay Maureen openly stating their interest. And then you have others such as Warner Brothers that is now out of the NBA game. Are they going to be looking at this? Like all angles.
Their current deal is $500 million average annual value combined for both their, and these deals were made at slightly different times, right? Their ESPN deal at first was just $300 million for 30 fight nights and 12 pay-per-view prelims, but then they sold the pay-per-view rights themselves exclusively behind a paywall to ESPN Plus for an additional $200 million average annual value.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, it seems that there's a lot of speculation of like breaking up the package, and that would seem to make a lot of sense. And I think it's a case of, you know, for an ESPN Plus, are they looking at taking like a portion of the pay-per-views? Would they want everything? I think you're going to have that case of just chopping things up and being able to separate these packages. And maybe that even means the pay-per-views. Like, do the pay-per-views have to be exclusive to ESPN Plus? Or can you, like, Netflix may want, hey, we want to have 4 pay-per-view cards, but we will pay for such that it comes with your subscription. Like, that's all. There's so many different options here, but that is music to their ears when there's all these bidders, and they will be as creative as they need to piece this up.
And you could see it making sense for Amazon, especially if they want to do some sort of pay-per-view type offering and a la carte those. But there is a non-monetary value, right, for UFC to be with ESPN, because is ESPN going to cover UFC to the same extent if they don't own all the rights?
No, they won't. Like, that's a huge factor of, you know, how much you get a residual bump from the ESPN coverage.
Is ESPN a little conflicted by owning all these sports rights and then covering all these sports in a journalistic manner?
I think we're long past that. I mean, they will figure out their priorities when it comes to sports. But I mean, how much of a player is a Warner Brothers Discovery? I mean, they have Max. They don't have a broadcast outlet, but they are, you know, once this next season is up, you know, they do have to replace a lot of windows, and UFC content could be very attractive to them. But to me, that is one that they will have to really pay for it, because I don't think you do get the same kind of, you know, the same kind of bump that a Netflix or ESPN provides that are not just realized monetarily.
Yeah, I could see it being split up. I would tend to think no, that there won't be a WBD piece there, even though they do have, they need to replace some value that's being lost by the NBA.
So the UFC media rights will continue to be a big story throughout this year, and where they are going to be going. Before we end things off, I did want to chat a little bit about the report that is sweeping the wrestling landscape. That is the WrestleNomics report. And Brandon, oh, you got another very engaging, very interesting opinion piece.
Are people engaging with it?
This past week. And the crux of this was looking at everyone's favorite topic is AEW, its identity. And instead of just laying out everything that could be going wrong here, you also had some solutions in place. And your belief is that handing off creative to one particular person with no strings attached would be a meaningful step in that direction for AEW to make a sharp pivot, as others have suggested and you put out here. What was your thinking on this? And
well, it's very similar to a conversation we had several weeks ago. But everybody gather around, make sure, let's get the numbers up here. Come on, everybody, come on in. We're going to talk about AEW's problems. This isn't going to happen. But as I wrote, I'm laying out all of these criticisms and issues that I think are central to AEW's decline in popularity, that it's not even clear if Tony Khan really acknowledges. Then I think the solution is to give head of creative control to Bryan Danielson. And I think that would be something that he would be good at. And I think it would correct a lot of the problems that I think are happening in AEW right now as it concerns nobody. And by the way, nobody's got AEW creative control, right? Well, they probably don't need it. I think there are, you know, talent who are on the upper end of AEW's cards who get a lot of leeway to change things and to, you know, get what they want. And I'm not sure that that's always the best thing for AEW, for the top wrestlers to have so much influence. That's understandable. And I think if you switched the rosters of WWE and AEW, you'd have the same problems and or non-problems in both of those companies. It's an issue of leadership and leadership being afraid to say no. I think it's totally understandable that you would have talent who are very self-interested, who are very competitive, and think very highly of themselves. Probably the same thing for the top talent in WWE, but there's a different leadership situation there. although we've pointed out the problems with WWE's leadership when it comes to particular hiring executives and whether or not they have a tolerance for people with a track record of allegations of sexual misconduct. I digress. But there's an issue of leadership around talent, I think, still today. And there's clearly that track record of, you know, the AEW lost not only its top babyface, CM Punk, I think largely not because the people involved, including CM Punk, didn't have issues, but because they didn't have the leadership to prevent that problem from getting even worse and leading to these physical altercations that led to Punk's firing. And they lost their top heel, who was Vince McMahon. And that caused it caused AEW to lose this galvanizing force that energized a lot of its fan base. It caused WWE to be a lot better in the eyes of a lot of fans, not in the eyes of people who really prefer AEW, who we hear from really loudly on social media, who love AEW and hate WWE. But it caused a lot more people to embrace WWE, as evidenced by trends we see in their TV ratings and their attendance. But what is AEW in that scenario where you no longer have that contrast to define yourself against? What is it? So far, it's becoming a WWE light, and that's reflected in the decline in its TV rating, even when you adjust for cord cutting. Even when you look at attendance that has none of these external factors, right? Their attendance is down as well.
You touched a bit about it in the piece as well. And it's not even like good, bad. You can have whatever opinion you want. But there are also key people that have been brought on by AEW. And you are somewhat limited. Like, you want people, I think, with wrestling experience. And in this level, that means WWE experience. So you do have, you know, people that are coming in, and what is their blueprint? It is WWE. And there's a lot of good you can take with WWE, but in that kind of institutional knowledge, you are somewhat adjusting your own DNA by compromising it. And there is going to be kind of that, if that is embedded in you, that WWE is the template of a successful wrestling promotion at the highest level that you are trying to aspire to, you cannot replicate that. And you get a company that I think is going to kind of, it shifts that identity. Where are you trying to mirror this? Are you trying to be a version of this? Or are you trying to be something totally different from this that others are going to just view as inferior by being the furthest thing from a WWE in this landscape?
But the issue is that I don't think that that's recognized. That's not a concern. I think the motivating factor for Tony is to create a show that he enjoys doing and that he thinks is great. And some people think is great, but it's creating a show that, you know, that appeases talent and, you know, appeases him. And I don't know. And you certainly don't get the impression from listening to the media calls or the press conferences that there's even an honest acknowledgement that something has happened with AEW's popularity that's even meaningful, you know. And I think a lot of that is just the personality of Tony and how he approaches those press appearances. But it's not clear that there's even a grappling with what's happening with AEW. I say all this while, yeah, they've now started their new TV deal, and that's probably going to make them profitable, I think.
Yep.
They're going to have to renew that deal in a few years, and then in a few years after that. And it's not just about the viability of AEW and making that company profitable and making the Khan family even more wealthy, but it's about having a strong AEW is good for the wrestling business. In a lot of ways, it's good for WWE. It motivates WWE to be better. It motivates WWE to pay wrestlers more, to perhaps treat and pay their staff more. So there's a lot of benefits, not just that it gives you another 5 hours, well, it's only 4 hours now, another 4 hours of wrestling content to watch each week, which it does.
How different do you think the attention would be if we adjust the timeline and this was their contract year and we're in this position right now, and you're looking at the end of this year. I mean, this is one, you know, 3 years is plenty of cushion for them to address issues, change things. And we also have no idea where cable is going to be in a year, much less 3 years. That AEW simply staying at a certain level might be a certain level. But I think you have to take into account a lot of different factors and where you are satisfied with. Ultimately, they have they are home free for 3 years. That is without question. But I think it does become an issue that, you know, this deal will have to get renewed at a certain point, and having those pieces in place that you want to be able to engage and make sure that this is an audience that is growing and not simply holding on to an audience and continuing to see declines year over year in a lot of these key areas. And attendance is a big one, a big factor. Like, that's not make or break for AEW, but it's a
expecting the product.
It's a great barometer, though, of just general interest in your product when you come to town one or two times a year, and how much interest there is for someone to leave their home and pay for a ticket to go see you.
And I would say it affects the value of the show to a major broadcaster.
It's a perception thing, absolutely. Like, you can't watch that Netflix premiere and then look at a Wednesday and, like, that is not a... That is not something that lands with your general consumer that is watching this. And part of this is it is a perception based business that you are selling on your television, and the natural contrast is going to be there.
And it's all well and good to be in the Manhattan Center and to not be. And I'm not saying they need to go to NBA arenas and wrestle in front of 2,000 fans, because that weakens the perception as well. But it's just the fact that if you could draw, as they could a few years ago, 5,000, 6,000 people to an arena, well, that enhances the production value, the value to your broadcaster, I would say. And I think I don't know if a few years ago when its ratings and attendance were stronger, that this would have been different. But I think it's notable that we haven't heard any more rumblings about a potential new TV deal with another major broadcaster. Like, Fox was rumored, Swerve Strickland was saying that they were getting a deal with Fox in a YouTube video, where it's not clear if he knew he was being recorded or not. And I haven't heard, as I wrote about in the report last week, I asked around and I couldn't get anybody to tell me that it was still alive, or that they, you know, thought it was still alive or heard it was. So I don't know that we're ever going to see an AEW Shockwave. And I, you know, if you look at the ratings of a Rampage or something like that, that may be sort of reflective of the level that you're getting. Although I'm sure in such a scenario they would load this show up and it would be a big deal, at least for the first episode. But it, you know, it's a tougher sell when you're cooled off.
Well, I encourage everyone to go read Brandon's piece. I think some of the best writing in the wrestling space, period, that's going on right now, in the WrestleNomics report, which comes out weekly at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. And let's end off on this, because we did not touch upon this, but earlier this week, Peacock put out several additional Saturday night's main event dates. So a week from Saturday is going to be their second show in San Antonio, with Hulk Hogan plastered over the promotional material. And then they have announced further dates for Saturday, May 24th, which is Memorial Day weekend, which, if Double or Nothing stays on that weekend, would be the next night traditionally. And then the more notable one would be July the 12th, which would be head to head with All in Texas from Globe Life Field that AEW will be presenting, which,
you know, they've taken it down.
Have they really? Oh,
I mean, we're looking live at the schedule on the Peacock website right now, and they have removed those dates that were there before. All that's there right now is the January 25th date that everybody knows about.
Okay, well, we will see if these dates become
subject to change, perhaps
a factor or not. But I think it's certainly, like, that July 12th date. If you have 2 hours of WWE on NBC, I definitely think that will hurt the All In event.
Yeah, I think so. Pay per view buys. I think it will. Now, that is the most hardcore product that you have, and I think that is the hardest one to erode, because I use the word casual, but if you're a casual viewer of AEW and if you're not committed to spending $50 on a pay-per-view, well, maybe, you know, whether or not you're going to have Saturday night's main event is not going to dissuade you if you're already a pay-per-view buyer. but we see, nonetheless, we do see when Saturday Night's Main Event or when other WWE program or when it's just an NXT show going head to head with Collision in particular, it does have an effect. Collision actually this week against a replay of NXT didn't get hurt, but that's not first run. When AEW is against even somewhere on the same day, not head to head, they do seem to have a negative impact when WWE is just, you know, there's a PLE earlier in the day, not even overlapping.
Yeah, it was a case like the NXT replay, which they did promote like decently the night before on SmackDown with The Rock being on the New Year's Evil special. Did I think it was 289,000 and a 0.04, but Collision was.
Have we sorted out whether that number is real, whether that NXT viewership is was not affected by the fire?
We so far that number has stood.
That, okay. As far as I know, that I haven't heard that it's been reprocessed. What can happen sometimes is in particular, because we're talking about CW and we're talking about a broadcast network, they have broadcast affiliates that, you know, I believe were breaking in LA, in the LA area with coverage of the fire. However, when we're talking about a final rating as opposed to a fast affiliate, when we're talking about a final rating, Nielsen is supposed to adjust everything and fix everything so that when they say NXT was only was watched by whatever the number is, they're referring actually to NXT, and they are excluding things that are coded or supposed to be coded as something else, even when it comes to breaking news. Now, when you're looking at the fast affiliate, and everybody out there remembers those times when there was preseason NFL on Fox on Friday night, the fast affiliate would come out and make it look like SmackDown had this giant number, then the final would come out and it would exclude all that NFL preseason viewership out, and you got a normal SmackDown number. That's not what is supposed to have happened here. And I haven't heard that it's reprocessed. And it makes sense that it was a big number because you had Ava on the show.
The key, the final boss. Final thing before we sign off, one more super chat here from Jumanji Hunter. How do you differentiate between AEW pay-per-view numbers still being great and lower television
numbers? Are AEW pay-per-view numbers? I mean, the Observer reports those numbers, and it's hard to verify them, and I think they're in the ballpark. But I think, as I said, it's harder. It is a hardcore product. It is a $50 product. It's not something that you watch as part of a TV package. And because that is such a, what I would call a bottom of the funnel product. It's a smaller audience. It's an audience that's paying a lot more per person as opposed to the TV show where people are not spending much, if any, money. And it's a much larger audience. It's harder to break those people that are down towards the bottom of the funnel. So as general fan popularity may erode, I would expect pay-per-view to be the most durable in that scenario. And I believe it is.
It's still, I mean, if you are what you are seeking from those AEW pay-per-views has not really changed all that much. Like, you get high quality shows pretty much now on a monthly basis.
You're delivering a product that people still like.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it is a different product now. It is more, I think, differentiated from the television that I think is more, you know, you have your shows that hit, you have your segments that people disagree with. But largely, like, this is a very consistent pay-per-view product that this audience has stuck with. And I think it does tell you that, once per month, like, this is, you know, the can't miss show that if you are an AEW fan, whereas a Collision might be more disposable. Dynamite is probably the show you are seeking out, but we have seen, like, there's a greater contrast when it comes to what the audience deems as important, what is must see, and the pay-per-views continue to hold that, which is a good sign. It's kind of the opposite of the TNA pattern that we always saw, where you got that consistent television audience of whether it was a million two, but their pay-per-view numbers, like, they were just never a giant.
Never over 60,000 is the belief, right? And these are,
yeah, and that was a pay-per-view that low. Yeah, and 60 was like, that was great for them. I mean, it was like that was a product that notoriously it was just, you did not have a high percentage of those television viewers that you can convert into pay-per-view buyers or people buying tickets. It was like they would watch the television, but they were not investing in your product in that degree, especially on a monthly basis. Yeah. But thank you very much for the questions. And that will wrap up the show. But Brandon, what is coming up in your world? I know Well, you can indicate or whatever. You are working on something big that hopefully will be coming out at some point, but we don't have to get into
I can say we're working on a follow-up on what we reported earlier this week about Odyssey Jones, also his real name, Omari Palmer. So we were working on that and hope to have it out soon.
All right. And the WrestleNomics report, as we mentioned, available each and every week at patreon.com/WrestleNomics.
Myself, and on Substack. Substack at WrestleNomics.substack.com. If you prefer Substack, it's there for you too. The report only is, still the best place to get everything is Patreon. But if you, I have been posting the report newsletter and the quarter hours on Substack. Both of them are $5 a month.
So you can get all of that. And if you are someone that says, oh, I love reading Brandon's work, but man, do I love hearing him tell me what he is reading or writing. Well, you can also get audio versions.
Oh, yeah, I've been recording audio versions. I actually learned that on Substack. As soon as I post a report, they have an AI voice that will read the report to you.
Really? Oh, yeah. Man, Substack is they're just pulling me in here. That sounds very attractive as an add-on. I will be back tonight. Waiting is off. So Bruce Lord will be joining me, the co-host of Collision Course. So we will go through Maximum Carnage. Okay. There's Carnage. Then there is Maximum Carnage. We're going to get the max version of it, on Max. So tune in tonight for that. And all can be found over at postwrestling.com, including Brandon's work as well. And last plug is that throughout the end of the month, we are doing a special at postwrestlingcafe.com. Sign up for an annual membership before the end of January, and it will work out that you get a whole free month of the cafe, which comes with plenty of bonus shows, extra audio that we put out, and early access to various work. So that is all at postwrestlingcafe.com. We're going to sign off. We will be back next Wednesday chatting about everything going on in the world of wrestling, and we will speak with you then. Goodbye.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.